Case number 12-1456 et al., United States Department of the Treasury, Internal Revenue Service, Office of Chief Counsel, Washington, D.C. Petitioner versus the Federal Labor Relations Authority. Howard Scher for petitioner, Zachary Henneke for respondent, and Peyton Larmore for intervener.
Please, the court. My name is Howard Scher. I'm representing the petitioner, Office of Chief Counsel and IRS, in this appeal. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. The issue in this case is whether or not the authority's decision to abandon the excessive interference test that it had used for 25-plus years in judging whether an agency head's declaration of non-negotiability was valid or not, and abandoning the excessive interference in favor of abrogation is a reasonable interpretation of the statute. The authority avoided any analysis of 7106, the provision in which appropriate arrangements is found. This court in the AFGE Local 2782 case at 702 F. Second focused precisely on 7106 and 7106B3 to come up with a resolution of the tension in the language of that provision to suggest that appropriate arrangements are those things that do not impinge to an excessive degree the rights of management that are protected in 7106A. The authority then accepted that analysis and on its own in the Kansas National Guard case accepted the excessive or created what was then known as the excessive interference test and applied that for years and years, 25 years, to both provisions that were declared non-negotiable as appropriate arrangements at the bargaining table and provisions then submitted to the agency head for review in the 7114C review by the agency head. The authority gives no discussion or analysis of 7106. Instead, it jumps to what it perceives to be a difference in the language in 7114C2, which is the agency head review provision, which talks about approving or non-approving in accordance with the provisions of this chapter and any other applicable law, rule, or regulation. If there's a violation of that provision, the agency head disapproves. And the difference between that language and the language in 7117C1, which seems to apply at the bargaining table, which says that the agency bargainers can declare non-negotiable anything in which it decides it's outside the duty to bargain. But our point is that when you measure those two provisions together vis-a-vis 7106A management rights, they are completely coextensive. Anything in the management rights provision, the substance of it, that is outside the duty to bargain is also non-negotiable. And so with respect to 7106A management rights, and that is the case here with discipline, there is no difference. And therefore, to the extent there should be one standard applicable, not two, one that says at the bargaining table a provision is valid, but at agency head review it's invalid, which makes no sense, the authority inappropriately decided to create this dual dichotomy setup when in fact the language it's relying on doesn't allow such a dichotomy to be established. The language it relies on creates a difference, but not with respect to 7106A, management rights negotiation, but 7106B1, those permissive subjects that management may, in its discretion, bargain over. There you can appropriately say, and this is actually the example the authority used as the basis for its complete decision to eradicate excessive interference at the agency head level, it pointed to 7106B1 bargaining. But there, at the discretion of the agency bargainers, they can bargain over the substance of the provisions or the subject matters that are at issue there. And it's not outside the duty to bargain if they decide to bargain over it. But it is, I'm sorry, it's not contrary to law if they decide to bargain over it, but it is outside their duty to bargain if they decide they don't want to because it's discretionary. But that is the only bargaining over 7106B1 where there's an ounce of difference between the language in 7114C2 and the language in 7117C1. And so there is no textual basis for abrogation. The only textual basis for a standard is the one this court pronounced in Local 2782 in the 1982 AFGE case, namely an excessive interference test, essentially, and it's worked well for 25 years. And we point out that in this court in the AFGE case in 1985 at 778F2nd,
well, there could be an abrogation test. The agency could interpret it. Your point is, whatever it is, it's got to be the same, correct?
That's one point.
Yeah.
And then the other point, Your Honor, I would make.
Right.
I'm sorry. Did I cut you off?
No,
too? I didn't mean to.
Yeah,
the other point I
heard
make,
you arguing that the only permissible standard is interference standard. That's not.
Well, some formulation that would have a balancing in it, like the excessive interference. I would say this court analyzed the 7106 language and came up with impinged to an excessive degree language. It seems to me abrogation is way over to the extreme and, in fact, is beyond impinging to an excessive degree. So to the extent this court has analyzed...
Well, that's the whole purpose, right, of the FLRA, to make it more extreme than to an excessive degree.
It seems to be that that's exactly what the FLRA wanted to do, claiming that they're deferring to the bargaining choices of the bargainers at the table. But Congress set up the agency head review, and in this court's 7 decision in the 1985 AFGE case, pointed to a whole host of reasons. The agency head is the backstop to prevent agency bargainers from ceding too much management authority, that the provision 7114C2 was to allow the agency head to do that which its subordinates could have done 30 days earlier. And among other policy concerns here, this court in AFGE in 1985 said Congress especially set up the agency head review provision in order to allow the agency head not to have a continuous burden of engaging in the day-to-day process of bargaining. But that's precisely what this kind of setup does, because if excessive interference, which the authority accepts as the proper standard, and that's where I wanted to also say to Judge Tatel's earlier question, they accept that as the proper standard, at the negotiating table.
If they did abrogation at both stages, you wouldn't be okay with that, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. We would say that based on this court's analysis in the 1982 case, that does not have a test that decides whether the exercise of a management right has been impinged to an excessive degree. It's beyond that. And I think this court wrestled with the tension in that case in 7106 to come up with its formulation, but I don't think the court would have ever thought that an extreme like abrogation, in which I don't know where abrogation actually begins or ends. The authority uses abrogation and or waiver, but we noted a hypothetical in our brief that we would think under abrogation, a proposal by the union saying you shall appoint or assign employee A to position X would be negotiable, even though it dictates the exact terms of the assignment, simply because management hasn't been barred from making the assignment. An assignment has, in fact, been allowed by such a statement. And we put that forth in our opening brief. As far as I could tell in combing the briefs, nobody took issue with that statement of how extreme abrogation is. So, and to add to this, of course, 2 members of the FLRA, member Armando Ruiz and then later member Beck, pointed out that it has been entirely a one-sided test, that management has never been able to meet it when it existed in the arbitration setting, that is to say when a grievance went to an arbitrator and then the review of whether the arbitrator was appropriately awarding something that could be characterized as an appropriate arrangement. The authority in such circumstances, I wanted to say something else and got myself stuttered on that. The In terms of the policy of allowing the agency head to have the additional 30 days, this case actually, in my opinion, wipes it out. And in essence, requires the agency head to become engaged in the day-to-day in order to have the first bite of review at the excessive interference level. And then, if abrogation is appropriately, it is appropriate under the authority's construct, then I would say the agency head would then exercise that authority later, but have a second bite to make sure that under abrogation there was no error. But I just can't see from this, the statute, any indication that two forms, two meanings to appropriate arrangements, two types of review ought to be allowed when, in fact, the agency head was established to make sure that his managers did not cede too much management authority, and the agency head was the backstop. And I point the court again to the 778 decision, I'm sorry, the AFGE decision in 1985, in which this court analyzed at length the authority of the agency head and why it was established and how delicate an issue that was in terms of both management rights and agency head when Congress was debating this provision in the statute. I want to emphasize that we are not claiming that when the agency head exercises authority at the under 7114C2 that the agency head is second-guessing or pruning or somehow able to reject a provision because the agency head simply doesn't like the wisdom of it. The agency head is simply constrained by what we call the contrary to law. The only reason the agency head can disapprove a tentative provision is because it's contrary to law, but contrary to law, as I say, means the same thing as outside the duty to bargain when it comes to 7106A.
Judge Wald in the 1985 case traced that to the legislative history of the Act.
Yes.
Precisely the distinction you're making.
If there are no further questions, I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Zachary Hennigy. I'm here on behalf of the Federal Labor Relations Authority. Contrary to the IRS's contentions, the Court here should defer to the Authority's reasonable interpretation in adopting the abrogation standard as applied to agency head review of agreed-upon provisions involving management rights. In my relatively short time, I'd like to focus on two areas. First, I'd like to look at the Authority's reasonable interpretation of the statute supporting legislative history, and specifically, the distinction between different provisions of the statute, one describing bargaining table issues and the duty to bargain, and second, 7114C2 describing agency head review and the agency head looking at, again, agreed upon contract provisions and the limited nature of that.
Both roads do not lead straight back to appropriate arrangements.
Part of this case absolutely is about appropriate arrangements, and the Authority here takes into account appropriate arrangements, but appropriate arrangements can mean different things in different contexts. Congress did not in the statute or anywhere else indicate
this is appropriate arrangements in the very same section.
Correct.
I mean, I understand that although there's a usual presumption that Congress uses the same word in the same statute to mean the same thing, this is the same phrase in the same place.
And appropriate in the AFGE case, 1985 case, excuse me, the local 2782 case, this court described the authority needing to look at appropriate arrangement and determine what that meant. Appropriate is inherently vague. Congress did not specifically describe what that meant. The definition of appropriate is suitable or proper to the circumstance. And here, the authority is not wiping away the excessive interference test. It's not disappearing. That standard still exists, and it's still going to exist, and the agencies have the ability to use that standard, and the authority will review proposals made at the table that the agency refuses to bargain over will review that under the excessive interference standard. The difference is, looking at 7114C2, that language in the statute very specifically describes agency heads reviewing or shall approve the agreement if the agreement is in accord with provisions of the statute and other applicable laws, rules, and regulations.
So under the authority's view, one agency, a contract in one agency might appropriately include this various sick leave provision and another might not, depending entirely on whether challenge comes up through the negotiability appeal or agency head decision, correct?
Correct. That could certainly
what
happen.
What sense
here.
Does that make?
Well, Your Honor, the weighing. What happens at the bargaining table, proposals pass back and forth, and the negotiators for the agency coming to the table, the excessive interference test is just part of it, involves applying the facts of any agency situation to the standard to a test that was announced in KANG, the excessive interference test. After after a proposal by the union is considered an arrangement, meaning that it adversely affects an employee and the proposal attempts to mitigate the management right that's being asserted, the second step is looking at whether it's appropriate. And under KANG, they list a non-exclusive five-part test. And the place to determine and weigh those factors, the authority is saying, is at the bargaining table. And after that's done, back and forth, and again, the agency's representative can say, we think this interferes with the management right and impinges on our right. They can say, we're not going to bargain over this. This is outside the duty to bargain. Then the union can file a petition to review that before the authority, and the authority will apply the excessive interference test. We're not getting rid of that.
I basically understand that procedure, but at both stages, the examination is of the proposal, right? Raw proposal, regardless of what may be negotiated within its terms. And that's the same before and after, right?
Well, to look at the terms, it's not the proposal. The proposal is something that happens at the negotiation stage. After the parties agree, we're calling it a provision, and that's a distinction that the authority looks at in describing why it sees that 7117 is different than 7114. In the statute, those two provisions, and in the regulations adopted by the authority, a distinction is made between a proposal and a provision. In a provision, we're talking about something that's already been agreed to by the parties, and again, where we think the weighing has already been done, and that we should hold the parties to that agreement. Under 7114, we're talking about, and the language specifically says, the agency head is looking at an executed agreement. This isn't the time for reweighing considerations of whether or not there are enough managers to cover something, or you can imagine a number of factors that would change the analysis of whether or not it impinges on a management's right. And the authority, all the authority is saying, in this second stage where the agency head is reviewing it, where the legislative history described the agency head review as being more limited. This court in the AFGE 1985 decision went through that legislative history. This court in the Montana Air Chapter 29 decision went through that legislative history, talking about executive order in 1962 setting up a broad scope in agency head review. Later on, late 60s, early 70s, separate executive orders limited that review to what's contrary to law. Congress adopted that language with the narrower scope. In this case, in the AFG 1985 case, this court said that it is a narrow scope. It's a high-level review. The agency head doesn't need to burden itself with all the different aspects of what's going on at the negotiation table. In Montana Air Chapter 29, again, this court says it's not going to let the agency head prune and get into that type of thing and pluck what it doesn't like about a collective bargaining agreement that's been agreed to. Analogous to these type of situations is the permissive subject to bargaining areas, where consistently, you know, it's outside the duty to bargain, 7106B1 specifically, outside the duty to bargain. It doesn't mean that the parties can't bargain over those things. And representatives from both the agency and from the union come to the table, they can choose to bargain over those things, and they will be held to those agreements that they make. An agency head is not going to be able to simply disapprove of those provisions. Excuse me. Second, this really does get into the aspect of the authority saying we're going to give deference to the parties making the bargain. They applied the excessive interference test to the contract fee cases that would require agency head to second-guess the bargaining choices would be a mistake. 7114B2 requires the agency to send competent, sophisticated representatives to the table. They have to be prepared and duly authorized to make these agreements. Those provisions mean something. It's recognized in EPA, the case that the authority adopted the abrogation standard to review arbitration decisions, described giving deference to the parties because it promotes collective bargaining. It enables parties to rely on the agreements that they come to. These things aren't meaningless. The abrogation standard is not meaningless. The negotiators are sufficiently aware of management rights, and time again, they refuse to bargain over management rights. The authority's decision in NTU, the 2011 decision that we're talking about the analysis here, multiple cases in a two-year period, just taking a slice, show that the bargainers at the table know what these rights are, know when to refuse to bargain over them, and they do. And the union has the mechanism to solve that problem, and they review that under the excessive interference test.
The authority's contention here, I take it, has got to mean that an impingement to an excessive degree is perfectly okay, right? Because if the excessive degree test survives, we wouldn't all be here, right? So it's got to be to an excessive degree rather than short of an excessive degree.
I suppose a couple of things, just to make sure I got your point right. We might be here if the test were still an excessive degree. If you disagree with the abrogation test,
correct.
Second, this isn't a limitless standard. It's two abrogation.
But by definition, it is not the to an excessive degree standard. So I take it, it's either meaningless or it says it's okay for it to be to an excessive degree.
I think the difference is the authority is going to give the deference to the parties that they already did that weighing, that balancing at the table, at the bargaining table. Once that there's an agreement made, We're assuming that the parties looked at the management rights aspects that, you know, could have been impinged upon. And when they signed off and sent that up for agency head review, the agency head should trust that its representatives took into account so that there wouldn't be any impinging excessively on a management right. And so then up to abrogation, contrary to law, other laws, a high-level review, the agency head in that way is limited. Important review for sure. In this case, for instance, we see that one aspect that was disapproved by the agency head, the authority agreed with. It was contrary to another law, Privacy Act. That was the education right issue. The system works. The agency head review is meaningful. It's a safety net, to be certain. But we are going to hold the parties to the bargain and assume and give them the benefit of the doubt that they've gone through that analysis and worked through those issues.
If we were to not agree with you on the statutory interpretation, agree with Member Beck, the IRS goes on to say that the sick leave proposal is not negotiable under the excessive interference test, and that we could resolve that here. Do you want to respond to that point?
Just quickly, Your Honor, two things. One, the majority did not analyze this under the excessive interference test. It should be remanded. The two cases that it cites, too, that say that's, you know, similar type of language in the provisions, in those two cases, the authority found that, in the first instance, the agency, in those cases, would not be able to discipline at all. In this case, very specifically, the authority found that the agency would be able to discipline in the first instance. There's a balancing that would need to take place. It wasn't done in this case. And second, there was another consideration that needs to be looked at. If the union didn't meet that standard, it alleged that it was a procedure under the statute, and the authority would need to look at that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I am Peyton Larimore for the intervener, the National Treasury Employees Union. I just wanted to quickly address a few different points that have been made during the argument. First of all, the authority did not avoid an analysis of Section 7106 in its decision, and pretty clearly AFTI Local 2782 left it up to the authority to determine what constitutes an appropriate arrangement. Appropriate arrangement is defined nowhere in the statute, and it is...
Court upset the authority's interpretation, right? In the 1983 case.
Right. In the 1983 decision in AFTI Local 2782, the authority had been applying what was called the direct interference test, and then Justice Scalia said that the statute does not define what is an appropriate arrangement, and it directed the authority to determine what appropriate arrangement meant. Specifically, he said the authority should, based on its knowledgeable estimation of the competing practical needs of unions and management, determine what constitutes an appropriate arrangement. And that is precisely what the authority has done in this case.
But isn't the challenge in this case, doesn't go to the definition of it, but the argument is that whatever it means, it can't possibly mean one thing in a negotiability appeal and something else in a head of agency appeal.
Well, I think the structure of the statute...
That's the answer. That's the argument.
That certainly is the government's argument, the agency's argument, but I think the structure of the statute itself lends itself to two different standards. As Mr. Hennigy explained, when you are at the bargaining table, a union and an agency are bargaining over whether or not something would constitute an appropriate arrangement, there's a give and a take that goes on between unions and agencies. And agencies are required to have duly authorized representatives to bargain. Once that proposal has been agreed to and the union, you know, there was no 7117 process, the proposal then becomes part of a contract, part of a provision. It becomes a provision in a contract. Then the agency head has 30 days to review that contract under 7114C2. An agency head review is intended to be a very narrow review, as this court recognized in 1994 in the Association of Civilian Technicians case. This narrow review is supported by both the language of the statute itself in 7114C2, as well as by the legislative history.
It's narrow in the sense that it goes to legality, which the feeds in 7106 means bargainability.
And it's
subject to the duty to bargain.
Right. It's narrow in the sense also that the agency head is not intended to get a second bite at the apple
that's
of
right.
everything that's been.
That's right. It's not reevaluating the deal.
Correct.
Talking about the legality
right.
of the agencies being forced into this position.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And why two different standards are appropriate is the abrogation standard, which, by the way, has been used before by the authority from 1990 to 2002 in the context of review of arbitration decisions under 7122. The abrogation standard appropriately defers to the party's choices at the bargaining table.
You say the party's choices, but is the agency head part of that party?
The agency head, yes, of course, is part of the party, but the agency head's designated representatives are the ones authorized at the bargaining table by the agency head to make that agreement.
And their bargain within the range of what is bargainable is fine. You can't interfere with that.
Correct. Once the parties have made an agreement at the bargaining table and that proposal becomes a provision, then the agency head's review of that provision is very narrow. In fact, the language of 7114C2 says that an agency head shall approve a contract unless it is contrary to law. It's a command. It's an instruction from Congress for the agency head to approve this contract unless it's contrary to law. And so that's why the appropriate, the excessive interference standard is appropriate at the bargaining table, and the abrogation standard is appropriate for agency head review.
Member Beck made a point about the practical effect of the decision being to impede and slow the bargaining process. Can you respond to that point?
I think that is purely speculative. Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't agency heads respond the way ordinary human beings respond to the risk of a curtailment of their authority?
If by that you mean whether or not agency heads would get more involved at bargaining at the table, the statute already requires them to have duly designated representatives who have the ability to bargain. So I think Member Beck's comment was purely speculative in that sense. If there are no further questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. Did Mr. Scher have any more time? Oh, go ahead. Sorry. I note that neither of the other two parties complained or contested our view that with respect to 7106A rights, 7114C2 and 7117C1 are exactly coextensive. That is to say, if a provision is outside the duty of the bargain because of 7106A rights at stake, it is exactly contrary to law for the same reason under 7114C2. The outside the duty to bargain language in 7117C1 makes sense because of the chronology of bargaining. At that point, the parties are at the bargaining table, and there are two things the agency bargainers can do. One, declare something non-negotiable because it's non-negotiable under 7106A, management rights, or declare it's outside the duty to bargain under 7106B1, pertaining to those things enumerated there, and make a determination that's outside the duty to bargain and not bargain because those are discretionary subjects. That's what the agency bargainers at the table can do. But once they've decided to bargain over 7106B1 subjects, the agency head can't declare that contrary to law. It's not. The discretion has already been exercised. What the agency head does in declaring something contrary to law is exactly what its representatives do at the bargaining table when they say it's outside the duty to bargain under 7106A. That is to say, it invades the substance of management rights to an excessive degree. And neither of the other the union nor the FLRA take issue with that analysis. They completely jump over it to say, well, there's a difference in this language. But the difference in the language only pertains to 7106B1 bargaining. It makes no sense with respect to 7106A. And what goes to the agency head is a tentative provision. It's not in the contract unless the agency head either approves it or doesn't act within 30 days. But up until that point, call it a proposal, call it a tentative provision. But the fact of the matter is Congress established the agency head as the backstop at that point, and the authority is removing all of that power and authority of the agency head by virtually, by demanding an abrogation standard that cannot and has not yet been met. And much of where the authority comes out in this case is derived from its EPA decision. Also in the 65 FLRA, it relied on that in its original NTEU Bureau of Public Debt case that I argued two years ago in front of Judge Tatel and other members that was declared in which there was no jurisdiction to review the case. But in EPA, and it's very important to recognize EPA involved arbitration. We don't agree that it was correctly decided, but it involved an arbitration, and the authority emphasized that what it was doing was distinguishing between the negotiation process and the process of enforcing a contract. And in enforcing the contract, it was going to impose abrogation. But the agency head is part of the negotiation process, so EPA doesn't get the authority to the place it wants to go.
Can I interrupt to just ask one question on if we were to agree with you on the law, remand appropriate to apply the excessive interference test to the provisions at issue here?
I wouldn't fight against that, Your Honor. I do believe, however, that the authority actually has said more than what it said here at the table about those provisions. Number one, it rejects, and I would commend the court to look at, I think it's pages 118 and 119 of the joint appendix, where the authority rejects the union's argument that this leave restriction letters are not discipline. And then on 119, rejects our reference to the two
FLRA cases, which I'll call briefly Local 858 and Local 1156 there, in which the authority at 119 says the only reason those cases are not applicable because they were decided under the excessive interference test. Having said all that and made my argument as to why I think the authority really has decided these issues previously, we would not object to a remand.
Okay. Thank you.